once they get into power, and that movement is gone. And then you come to the 90s era, 90s and I call it post 90s phase, where actually we have all these neoliberal policies came in India, in Indian higher education, and that changed the nature of higher education. Another point is that a big faction within student movement who is fighting for the affirmative action policies. I mean, in a way, it was similar that how in the US also this movement was going on, but here the policy was implemented on a different, at least at some scale, but we are still fighting for the affirmative section, which we call the reservation policy. So this is one section where actually I'll discuss later that how the identity movement started with the implementation of the affirmative policies. So now you see there are three sections, three broader categories. One is the nationalist movement, you know, the right wing, and then you have left liberal, and there's a whole group of left people, and then you have this independent identity-based movement based on caste identity, regional identities, linguistic identities, and also the reservation faction, mm-hmm. which binds all that together. So, mm-hmm. so at present in India, this is the main area of study, that how these reservation movement is affecting the entire student politics. So I think maybe in the next section we'll discuss how it is affecting.
Okay, so
I have a lot of questions for you.
Sure. I'm just going to go through a really brief overview of my own development as an activist. I'm 31 years old, and I spent about 7 years as a professional student activist before leaving that, giving my take of what the development of student activism has looked like since the 1960s. I was born in 1987, actually just a couple of blocks from here at the Columbia Hospital for Women, which is now Condos, which is also reflective of history. Was in college between 2006 and 2010. I took a year off between high school and college and did an AmeriCorps program called City Year, which is a legacy of both the New Deal and the Great Society, very sort of like mainstream liberal, do-gooder type stuff. When I was in college, I got deep into ethnic studies activism, a lot of queer justice work. I was part of a student organization on my campus. I went to a small liberal arts college in Oregon called Willamette University, and I was part of an organization that won a Center for Equity and Social Justice, and full funding and staff for that, that got gender-neutral housing on campus. Changed the dorms, ran a failed campaign to get the Board of Regents to divest from fossil fuels. So very much sort of a part of the core of student movement at the time. In 2008, I spent 6 months living in Nicaragua studying with Sandinistas because I was curious about the history of armed struggle and what that might look like in the United States. I think my reaction to it can best be summed up by Michael Hart's entry in the movie Examined Life, which is a really good documentary produced by Astra Taylor, where he talks about being in El Salvador in the 80s and sitting down with some FMLN guerrillas and then asking them, like, what can I do? What do I need to do? And they're like, oh, you make revolution. He's like, what does that mean? And they're like, oh, you just get guns and you go up in the mountains and you make revolution. He's like, oh, no, like, I can't, that's not even a thing. I would just die. And so that was very much my response to. And during that time, I spent a lot of time reading about the 60s, especially 1968, and the sort of, you know, that as a pivot point for international left movement. Read probably a dozen books on the Weather Underground, also the Black Panthers and the Black Liberation Army and the Brown Berets and the Chicano movement and a bunch of others. So this has been very much part of my sort of formation, is sort of looking at that era and those actors as a point of reference, and Mark Rudd in particular as a cautionary tale, this is what happens when things go bad.
You're one of the few people who's ever taken my advice.
I mean,
about studying history.
Yeah. Well, so I mean, so I actually think that there are a lot of folks. I mean, so I am deeply suspicious of David Hogg. I am deeply suspicious of David Hogg. His dad is an FBI agent. He burst onto the scene. He's a media darling without any sort of analysis, and I don't think that he's actually going to make much difference in the long run. But I do think that there are a lot of people who are studying history and who are learning a ton. I think that you'll see a ton of Black Lives Matter activists wearing shirts that say Asada taught me, referencing Asada Shakur, the Black Liberation Army militant who was busted out of prison and is currently in exile in Cuba. You'll see lots of folks referencing things like the Weather Underground as a cautionary tale. You'll see folks referencing the sort of developments since then. So I think that the long 1960s looms large in the history of student activism globally and in the United States. It's how it sort of created the grammar for student activism. It's how we think about it. It is the permanent point of reference for us. But a lot has changed since then. There were a series of post-insurrectionary movements in the 1970s and 80s, including the New Communist Movement, which is the most direct inheritor of the Weather Underground and the Black Liberation Army. There were tons of other movements, the anti-nuke movement, anti-apartheid, responses to urban racialized poverty, including the Welfare Rights Organization, the Central American Solidarity, Affirmative Action, Environmental Justice, Gay and Lesbian Movement, Ethnic and Gender Studies were consolidated. There was punk and DIY culture, the sex wars and feminist theory and feminist activism, developmentalism. There were also a huge explosion on the right, of movements on the right with youth, with a bunch of yuppies, anti-abortion activists, Youth for Reagan, anti-busing activists, and the proliferation of the drug war. So that's like the immediate sort of like period right after that long 1960s. After that, there was a period of sort of militancy and juxtaposed against neoliberalization. After Reagan, there was a sort of student movement in the 90s. Looked a little bit more vibrant than it did in the 80s. You saw sort of an alter-globalization movement emerging, multiculturalism was big, along with sort of resurgent cultural nationalism. There was a lot of stuff happening, ACT UP, disability militancy, student fees and tuition, Earth First. You also saw, welfare reform. You saw the National Crime Bill. You saw the sort of start of the attacks on public universities that has led to the sort of astronomical ballooning in student debt and the sort of restructuring of them to be more instrumentalized. Then after that, I think that the anti-Bush and anti-war years were really important, and that was sort of formative for me. My first protests in high school were against the Iraq War, against Afghanistan first and then Iraq. And I think that we saw a big restructuring there, and then I think we saw another restructuring after the financial crisis in Occupy. I think folks started taking seriously the idea of insurrection again, looking to Greece and Quebec and Chile and Mexico and France. I think that that folks were also being sort of professionalized. You saw the professionalization of a lot of activism, right? There was an emerging critique of the nonprofit industrial complex, right? There were all these leadership pipelines. If you wanted to work in the Democratic Party, if you wanted to work in Planned Parenthood, if you wanted to work in with the Sierra Club, they all had youth arms. There were all of those things. And I think that we're actually in a new period now, since the financial crisis in Occupy, where there has been another shift, and now we're in a sort of moment of non-recovery, right, after the financial crisis, a moment of trying to figure out how to move activism back from the internet to offline spaces, of fighting back against repression, and of media movements. And we've seen a bunch of emerging movements like Black Lives Matter, the Boycott, Divest, and Sanctions movement, Me Too. We've seen a bunch of socialist movements, especially the sort of explosion of the DSA, Abolish ICE, the Sunrise Movement, Standing Rock. We've also seen the ascendancy of the alt-right. We've seen increased astroturfing organizations like Turning Point. We've seen a lot of anti-protester laws and regulations, and we've seen the rollback of a lot of victories from the Obama years. So I think that we're in a time of incredible volatility. I think that we are in a time where the history of student movement has been shaped by sort of shorter and shorter waves. right? Where sort of like the long 1960s was longer than the sort of post the sort of post-insurrectionary movements of the 70s and 80s, which were then shorter than the post-Reagan militancy, which are then shorter than the anti-Bush, which are then so, you know, we're seeing this sort of like shrinking horizon, and I think that contemporary student activism seems to be going really well. I think is actually incredibly attentive to history, and I think is really doing some great and interesting work, despite the fact that there are lots of horrifying things happening right now, and we're in a time where things are really scary.
Okay, thank you, Sam, sorry, for a slight revisionist view of history, if I may, and then...
Wait a minute, I'm the revisionist.
I guess so.
Yeah. Yeah. Post-revisionist.
Yeah. Oh, boy. So many threads to pick up on, but I think I'm going to pick up from where you, the question you asked. Does it make sense for us to ask David Haig to slow down and learn history? And I know Sam said that, according to him, that people are learning history. I have to say that in my experience, it's not necessarily the right kind of history that is being learned. People are very selective about the kind of history that they learn. One of the things that I became very conscious about, now my, before I launch into that, just very, very briefly, who the hell am I? And I'm not an academic, I'm not even in grad school. What I do is, after about 20 years as a conflict management person working in India, a couple of other countries, as well as the US, I became so petrified about the state of our democratic societies that I stopped doing this work. And for the past 3 years, before Trump, I hasten to say, before Brexit, I stopped doing my professional work because I figured the only thing that I can do in good conscience is to not focus on my career, not focus on my company, which is a conflict management company, but to focus on collaborating with people who are equally concerned about the state of our democratic system, the political system. And the last 3 years, I have failed miserably. I have made no difference at all, and I have no qualms about saying that. The reason why I want to pick up your question about history is one of the things that I have discovered, much to my chagrin, in talking with my entire social network, all of whom are extraordinarily liberal, many of whom are very progressive, many of whom have PhDs and almost all of them have masters, is how little history they know. The entire history that they seem to operate out of is about colonization and post-colonization. Everything boils down to many of my friends and peers in terms of slavery, Western colonization, and how to fight that. And that's just one part of history. And when I look at democracy, which for me is not elections at all, and when I look at what has happened in India over the past 30 years and why we now have a right-wing nationalist government that is, as Gaurav knows only too well, completely changing the institutions as well as the culture and moving it away from a liberal secular framework to one which is right-wing and nationalistic, I am terrified. And I see this, I've been working not only in India and the US, but I've been working in other countries. And this is a global phenomenon. I have been, and there are others who say that Trump is not the problem. He is like an abscess on the skin, a boil or a wart that, you know, needs to be dealt with. But even if you take it away, there are huge problems that are structural, not just, I hasten to say, when I say structural, not just structural racism or sexism. There are far deeper challenges. And for me, it's almost as though I found myself saying that if you don't know something, as a citizen of a or a resident of a democracy, you have a responsibility to find out. If you have an opinion, you have an even greater responsibility to really substantiate it. Because guess what? The difference between, and this is a thought exercise that I have. Imagine you take the entire population of a non-democratic country like China or Saudi Arabia and transplant it here and move all the Americans out of this country. How long do you think American democracy would last? With all the institutions, with no right-wing, American right-wing, with no races, you've just brought Saudi Arabian citizens here or Chinese citizens. I would wager that this country would lose its democracy in less than a generation, because democracy requires a citizenry that can think, that can exercise its franchise in an intelligent and generous manner, that can also has the tools and skills not just to protest and resist, which is very important, and that's what the theme is here, but also to know when not to resist, when to compromise, and when to say what I need, even if it's very important, I'm willing to defer to tomorrow, because the political system that allows me to advocate and to protest also needs to stabilize and be protected. So here's my last thought, and I just want to put it out there, because I'm concerned that the role, and Gaurav and I were talking about this a week ago. I think protest and activism serves a very different purpose in a democratic society as opposed to in an authoritarian society. In an authoritarian society, you protest because nobody is listening to you, and there's no way you can do anything but bring down the system. Tahrir Square, and that whatever Tiananmen Square was all about. And the authorities have only one recourse to your activism: shut you down. In a democracy, on the other hand, there's an implicit understanding that you can negotiate even if you don't get what you want. And protest is to facilitate that negotiation, which is why Obama said once to the students in campuses, it's great that you folks are wonderful at protesting and wonderful at resisting those who are anti-race, and I mean those who are racist and sexist and everything else. But once they agree to come to the table, and I'm paraphrasing him very badly, you have a responsibility to go to the table and negotiate with them. You cannot continue to fight, because that's what you do in an authoritarian system, not what you do in a democratic system. Protest and activism is a very vital tool to push the other person to the table for negotiation. It doesn't mean you will get what you want. So my only interest right now is, we are at risk of losing the only system, political system in human history, that has allowed this extraordinarily diverse group to sit here and even have this conversation. Try having this conversation in China or Saudi Arabia or the United Arab Emirates. These gentlemen and me will disappear. So I love student activism, provided we understand the distinction between activism in a democratic country and activism in a non-democratic country, including just one other thing. It doesn't matter how corrupt or messy the democratic system is. You still have to recognize that there are certain rights that you have there. The right to have a right itself is something that a democratic society at some levels recognizes.
Can I?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So, I completely agree with what Ashok said about democracy. And I think within the democratic structure, all these identity processes or identity-based movements are possible, which let me talk to that, talk about that, and how actually this process take shape. It's not possible in authoritarian regime. So now, You must have heard, many of you have heard, in 2016, this was he's a Dalit student who committed suicide in one of the southern part of southern university in India called Hyderabad Central University. And his suicide led to a huge student movement in India. Why? Because he left a suicide note. And this suicide note is the kind of became the basis of this whole uproar. And when this movement was going on, I think from every part of the world, actually all these intellectuals, they wrote a letter to the Prime Minister of India that, you know, do something with their higher education, the kind of, so he committed suicide because his issues were not addressed in the university, and his scholarship was stopped, and there were only because he belongs to a lower caste. So there were all these caste, and this led to, of course, the caste-based movement has been, as per my understanding, has been going on for past 15 years almost, kind of very actively, but in past 5 years, past 10 years, in one past decade, it has been bringing out all those notion to understand what we call, we're talking about history, like how now student movement in India, especially one section who is the subaltern, the Dalits and the other backward classes, they are in a process of rewriting history and challenging that dominant or the hegemonic structure in higher education. Now, let me again, I keep approaching the same issue from a different angle. So now this picture is sent to me by a friend who topped the Master of Technology exam in JNU. And now, because we are being ruled by a right-wing government, and it's the first time, Deepa, in JNU happened, we never had this kind of category openly displayed. Mm-hmm. And now, in the now, especially when we raise a discourse about all, like how in this system, how identity of a student is kept secret, and grades and everything is kept secret, and now you see what's happening in India. So here you have SC and SC, like scheduled caste, scheduled tribe, you have other, you have physically handicapped, and then you have unreserved students. So there's people who are with quota, with affirmative action policies. So now this person, when he approached me and wrote an email, and he said, it took me 4 years, because he comes from a rural background, he said it took me 4 years to top this exam, and the day when I was sitting on these chairs with all my credentials, you know, and these are the clerks who has to verify those, and he said when they were shouting in their microphone that OBC, he means other backward class, he said, I just didn't want to get up and, you know, face him. And I was kind of, I wanted to run away from that movement, and I did. Mm-hmm. He said, I came next day and I saw that if there is nobody from my class, then I will go to approach. So this is just one example, and we did a whole project of understanding that how this identity process takes shape. Why I'm discussing you now, because in student activism, there is a reason that why I'm discussing this kind of identity issue here, because what I notice in past few years that activists in India are committing suicide, and that is a kind of big question for us to understand. If activism is like for me, I'm not a psychologist or psychiatrist. As a layman to psychology, I used to understand that people who are introvert, they go in depression. The people who are introvert, they go in and commit suicide. But here, when activist, this guy was an activist in who led the who was very active in Hyderabad Central University, and he hanged himself. And then there is a series of activists who are hanging himself. So you can see the kind of pathology we are dealing in the higher education. So as a result, what is happening here, this is some of the news I put together. And one of our colleagues from London, David Moss, he concluded in his study of 30 years in southern part of India, he said, now caste has turned inwards. It is not, you cannot see it openly, like as it was earlier, that, you know, lower caste, they were, you know, there was no even clothing on their body. But now it has changed. Now people are coming, being educated, entering in the system, but then they have to face that stigma and prejudice. And as a result, and this is the shocking data, that how many students are committing suicide in higher education. And now recently I was attending in India a conference on called BRICS Higher Education Summit, and where people were standing whole day, they were discussing this data on ranking and excellence on higher education. You know, that's what the market trend is. And when I showed them this data, I posed them a question. I said, does this data fit somewhere in your ranking? Or is it the effect of this ranking business? You know, for this section, this 35%, these lower castes in India, for that section, just making it to higher education itself is a big deal. And who would care about your ranking and your excellence? So these are the question, actually, which is the other side. But now you see, I'm presenting the active side, where what these lower castes in India for past 10 years doing.